Hello, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, and I lead the Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative. Welcome to my podcast series, Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Why a podcast? Well, I wanted to combine three things I love: walking, listening, and learning, as the title suggests. I'm also passionate about people and finding engaging ways to discuss issues. So thanks for joining me. Today's conversation is all about mass incarceration, and more specifically, how communities of color all across Illinois are impacted. My guest is Yaakov Delaney, and I'm so very proud to say that Yaakov serves as a policy coordinator for the Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative within the Office of the Lieutenant Governor, and he does a tremendous job focusing on justice reform at the state level. Yaakov has also worked as an organizer for restorative and criminal justice reform at the Community Renewal Society, and he is the founder of Breaking Cycles, a support group that uses trauma-informed care to assist justice system-impacted people as they go back into their families and their communities. Welcome, Yaakov. Thank you for walking, listening, and learning with us today.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and I appreciate being able to sit here and have this conversation with you today.
Me too. I'm excited. So, Yaakov, there's been a lot of conversation around mass incarceration and criminal justice reform, and particularly the impact of mass incarceration on Black and Brown communities. And I don't typically start these kinds of conversations with a lot of statistics because I'm much more interested in hearing what you have to say, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important to just put forth a few key statistics just so people understand a little bit about the numbers that we're talking about when we're talking about incarceration here in the state of Illinois. So right now, approximately 72,000 people in Illinois are behind bars in various kinds of facilities. So just to start that off, like when we say various kinds of facilities, what are we talking about? 72,000 people aren't just in state of Illinois prisons, right?
Correct.
So what does that mean, different facilities?
In Illinois, they may be in federal prisons, state prisons, local jails, community control, and that could consist of probation, supervision, or house arrest.
Okay. So we'll come back to that because I want to talk about the difference between jail and prison when we get this conversation going. Yeah. So, but 72,000 people in Illinois are behind bars of various kinds, and approximately 42% of the Illinois population has a criminal conviction or arrest record. Mm-hmm. So that means that out of our whole population, 42% of our population has either been arrested at some point mm-hmm. and has a record, or that person has been convicted of some sort of offense.
True.
Okay, so that's a big number, 42%. So just to give a little more historical context, between 1977 and 1992, the Illinois prison population tripled. It started in 1977, close to around 10,000 people that were in Illinois prisons, and then that ballooned to about 32,000 people 25 years later. Mm-hmm. And then in 2013, the Illinois prison population ballooned to about 49,000 people. I know that today, the Illinois prison population is around 38,000, with about 54% of that population being Black or African American, 31% white, and 12% Hispanic. And so when we talk about 54% of the current prison population in Illinois, 54% being Black, that is a disproportionate number based on the population of Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get those statistics out of the way because I don't want to talk just statistics. I want to talk more about sort of what's happening in real life with people's lives.
Yes.
So let's start, Yaakov, with this question because people, I think, kind of know the word incarceration. Mm-hmm. But what does mass incarceration really mean? How is that distinctive?
Yes, and those are some staggering numbers that you read off. So the technical term mass incarceration refers to the unique way the United States has locked up a vast population in and as you mentioned, federal, state prisons, local jails, and it's including community controls such as probation, supervision, house arrest. And on a more personal level, like as a young black male growing up in the 70s on the southwest side of Chicago, during the time the war on drug policies were implemented. And I seen like firsthand how my father returned home from serving in the Army with a heroin addiction. And instead of receiving treatment for his diseases, he was eventually sentenced to prison, leaving behind his wife, which was my mother, and three young children. And then came in the 80s, tough on crime punishment philosophy, and combined with the war on drug legislation. And I witnessed a lot of my relatives get swept away, a large portion of my community members who suffered drug-related issues all got swept into the prison system, leaving behind children and families.
Right.
So from the perspective of many black and brown people who are disproportionately make up over 60% of the Illinois prison population, mass incarceration has become a very harmful and disturbing norm and has created a wide range of unwanted consequences for society, communities, and families, and has not substantially reduced crime.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the things that comes up, that we talk about public safety, and everybody wants to be safe. Like, there's no one that I've ever talked to who says, no, I don't want to live in a safe community. But what we often talk about as it relates to mass incarceration, you have talked about it. You've talked about how generationally it has caused harm and policies that led to so many people being incarcerated disproportionately from black communities and brown communities. And what we don't see, though, is that that has necessarily translated for many of these same communities into safe communities.
Correct.
So what is happening? Like, what is that harm that's being done? Like, you talked about families and children are impacted. What happens if communities aren't becoming safer?
Communities are being traumatized through the incarceration of mass amounts of people, family members, whether it's your cousins, your brother, father, mother, sister. These communities are being traumatized through the contact with the jails and the prison system on a daily basis.
You know, we're going to talk about trauma more. We've talked about it in one of our episodes, but it has come up in every single conversation that I've had in this podcast, whether we talk about restorative justice, whether we talked about juvenile justice, whether we talked about reentry. One common theme throughout has been trauma. So you talked about how mass incarceration has traumatized entire communities. What does that mean? What does that look like? And why is it so traumatic for these communities, as you've described it?
Yes, it's no coincidence that trauma has bubbled up as a reoccurring theme. Trauma is very real in our lives. And what I've learned in my own experience is that parental incarceration is now recognized as an adverse childhood experience. And it's sort of distinguished from other adverse childhood experiences.
Can I hold on and just make sure you explain, what is an adverse childhood experience? I know ACEs, but for those who may not know, what is an adverse childhood experience?
So an adverse childhood experience is, it's a term that's used in social work that describes the experiences that a child may have growing up from starting at the age of, I think, an infant stage, where they may experience something in their lifetime that has inflicted some type of trauma on them that most children eventually live with sometimes throughout the rest of their lives if it isn't addressed properly.
And that could affect how they perform in school. It could affect their relationships with others. It could affect their behavior, all because of oftentimes unaddressed trauma.
Correct.
Yeah. So, okay. So you said that I want to make sure you keep going, but mm-hmm. One of the things you said is that children of parents who have been incarcerated, that's considered an adverse childhood experience.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And it's through the unique combination of trauma, shame, and stigma that children of incarcerated parents experience. And so when we talk about the Illinois prison population, it's important to keep in mind the children who have been impacted by mass incarceration, the unaddressed trauma that these children live with and eventually become adults. There's a saying that hurt people hurt people. And you know this saying by you being a restorative justice practitioner. And learning about trauma and how to deal with it is what led me to start my own trauma-informed care support group for system-impacted people and families like 4 to 5 years ago, because I was once a child of an incarcerated parent.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I ended up in the criminal justice system at the age of 19. And during my entire time of being in prison, there was no particular program that taught me about trauma or that helped me to understand the harm that had been caused to me and the harm that I had eventually inflicted upon someone else. And so this is a missing component in our reentry process by failing to address trauma in people who are incarcerated. Most people who are incarcerated will eventually be released. And if we're never addressing the healing process of the people that's incarcerated, then we never really get to the healing process of our families and communities that have been impacted by poverty, drugs, violence, and mass incarceration.
And I think it's so important to like pause right there for a moment to mm-hmm. just allow time and space to kind of visualize that cycle. That if we really do believe, and I know we talked about it in our episode on restorative justice, that hurt people, and both of us, of course, are restorative justice practitioners and advocates. So hurt people, so people are hurt.
Mm-hmm.
They then hurt other people, mm-hmm. and that can lead them into the system, the
Correct.
Justice system. But in the justice system, if there's not something that's done to address that hurt, they come back to community, and most people do,
mm-hmm.
they're still hurt. And still with the capacity to keep hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, it sounds like from some of the work that you've been doing, if you don't understand what it might be like to have a parent that was incarcerated and the hurt that that does or the harm that that does, or if you don't address and bring trauma-informed services, you have a lot of people. When we talk about 38,000 people in our state prison system
right.
who may or may not get those kinds of trauma-informed services, I know we're working hard to make sure that that's more readily available. But coming back to community, you haven't gotten to that root. You haven't gotten to the core. And that can then lead to why we see so many people cycling in and out of this system.
Correct.
So I want to talk a little bit about what happens when people come back home or come back to their communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lot of conversations about second chances. What do you think is most important in light of your work? And maybe you want to talk a little bit more about the work that you're doing with your trauma-informed, the group that you've started, the organization. Why is that work important? And what do people really need? You know, what's most important as we think about people coming back to their communities? And then maybe talk a little bit about some of the challenges. Like, why is it hard? You know, I know that people kind of say, okay, you're out. I don't want to see you again. You know, go out and live your life. It's not always that simple.
It's definitely not. And there's a lot of reform efforts that's being addressed for the legal barriers that men and women face coming home, such as housing barriers, employment barriers. What people don't know is that once a person acquires a criminal record, then there's employment barriers. This person may not be able to get a job in certain areas or in certain fields. There's housing barriers. A person with a criminal record may not be able to get a home
mm-hmm.
or get an apartment in a certain neighborhood to provide for his or her family.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are basic necessities of life. Healthcare and education barriers that prevent people from becoming productive citizens, mm-hmm. that prevent people from taking care of their children. And so I often like speak of when people come home, some people know about the legal barriers that's currently being addressed in reform areas, but I often speak about some of the hidden barriers that formerly incarcerated people face, such as the shame and the stigma of incarceration, getting to know their families again, and most importantly, access to opportunities so that people can live productive lives. When I returned home from my incarceration almost 6 years ago, it was through an opportunity to volunteer at a legal organization that allowed me to feel confident in the skill sets that I had, and which eventually led to a paralegal position. Mm-hmm. And so just wanted to use a quote from you, Lieutenant Governor. You stated that when thinking about criminal justice reform, we can't have that conversation without thinking about equity and opportunity. And the lack of equity and opportunity is what leads people to the justice system.
That's right.
When people return, it's the lack of equity and opportunity that leads them back.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to pair these two paths, these two issues, to address how we create real paths for people returning back home into our communities, because only then will we see people thriving and becoming more confident in who they are and what they can contribute to our communities and to society as a whole.
You know, I want to pick up just a little bit about the sort of unseen barriers that you talked about. Because I think in general, when people talk about people returning back to their communities from the justice system, the talk is often, you know, what about housing and education and then and healthcare and, economic opportunity or jobs. But I don't know if we have a lot of very public conversations about shame and stigma that is relating to exiting the justice system and what that means and why it's considered a barrier. Can you talk just a little bit more about how that plays out, how that is, how that ends up? I mean, I think most people listening understand what stigma and shame is, but what happens? How does that play out in real life and trying to come back and say, okay, I'm ready to be a productive citizen and contributing member to society?
So a person that has been incarcerated, and just speaking from my own experience, spending years in prison and then returning back to society, sometimes people are spending 10, 20 years in prison, and there's been technological advancements, and so people are trying to like catch up to what has been happening since their time spent in prison, and becoming,
because technology advances anyway. Technology is something is obsolete, you know, within a year or two, it's something new that's created. So imagine over 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, and what I learned during my incarceration is that I encountered many men that were had reading disabilities or had comprehension disabilities. And so that in itself is a barrier for folks. I often tutor men that I was incarcerated with. And so coming back home and some of these men and women trying to get a job and trying to fill out application and having certain limited capabilities, that could pose a barrier for them. They may not want to even talk to the next person and let them know, well, I can't understand this when I'm filling out this application because of that shame. And then having to live with the shame of already being gone for X amount of years. And so these are some of the barriers that men and women face coming home, coupled with the barriers of having to get past a job interview, the barrier of having to get past, have you ever been convicted of a criminal offense, on a housing application.
Right.
And so that's the shame that people live with on a day-to-day basis with having a criminal record.
You know, you brought up something as well about kind of re-engaging with family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the case that it's just, okay, family, my family member's coming home, let's pick up where we left off. It's been 10, 15, 20 years. What are some of the challenges with that family reunification? And sometimes, by the way, that includes children, not just siblings or spouses or partners or parents. It's children, too.
Definitely. And so, yeah, you have someone that was incarcerated and a child may have been 5 years old at the time they were arrested and have and now has spent 10 years in the prison system and coming home to a teenager that is going through hormonal changes, that's going through their own maturation process and have their
things teenagers do.
Exactly. And, but also have the trauma of their parent being incarcerated. And so and not being able to build that bond. I experienced my own issues with my son, who was a young baby when I was incarcerated, and when I returned home, was grown, was an adult with a child. And so just having to try to make amends and redevelop a relationship with a person that's your family member, that's your son or daughter or parent or mother, father, sister, it's often difficult.
It's something that we don't often think about.
We don't often think about that.
And
I hear that.
When we talk about sort of reform efforts or talk about people returning to their communities, I've often either said or heard the phrase that when someone is incarcerated, the whole family is incarcerated in many ways. Because, you know, as you said, a child, a family member, they all have to deal with the emotional, the trauma, the just the struggle and challenges of having a family member incarcerated and that reunification. So I think it's important then that as we think about reform efforts, that that be a part of it. What does the family need as well?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And that's some of the work that we are doing at JEO. We're currently...
JEO being our Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative.
Correct.
I'm very proud of that work.
We're currently collaborating with the Illinois Prisoner Review Board to establish a first-of-its-kind restorative justice program inside of the Department of Corrections and seeking to... heal the harm that's been caused to survivors of criminal offenses, but as well as the person that's committed the offense.
Yeah. I think that you speak so eloquently about the reason why people with lived experience must be a part of this work. That for somebody who's on the outside to just say, this is what people need as they come out, or this is what they need while they're in the system. We need people who have had that experience who can share their own experiences and perspectives to help us think through these reform initiatives. Because I don't know if people would otherwise be able to think about the trauma that's caused by mass incarceration. You know, I want to just kind of, you talked about some of the barriers. I want to close out by just talking a little bit more because I don't know, when we talk about 38,000 people, a lot of times people kind of have the mindset of, well, yes, they're there, they need to stay there, we don't need to offer programs or do other things or help when coming back because, you know, they shouldn't have done what they did, and and just kind of leave it at that and not remember that extra piece that most people are coming home. And when people come home to your community,
95%.
That's exactly right. And you want people to be continue to be, they're your neighbors, they're your family members, they're your coworkers, and whatever. So what are some of the things for people who deserve second chances? And you know, I believe that. What do people need to be successful with that reintegration?
People need jobs. People need welcoming community members. People need support and opportunities. People need health care, access to health care, access to, did I mention housing?
No.
People need need access to housing. And some of these things, as I mentioned, are basic necessities. Like we need food. We need water in order to exist here as human beings. People need basic necessities such as housing. Mm-hmm. People need employment opportunities to be able to provide for themselves. And also, we know there's a great percentage of folks that's incarcerated that have children, to be mm-hmm. able to provide for their families and to be able to contribute back into their communities, which they may have caused the harm to that led them to be incarcerated in the first place.
Yeah, I'm really proud that so many of those areas of need we are working on through the Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative, whether it be our pilot project on housing, mm-hmm. The task force for children of incarcerated parents, the restorative justice pilot that you talked about, to really think about that sort of just family impact and addressing the trauma. It's just been a real privilege to have you on our team and to have you contributing so much to thinking about the solutions that we need to have to address the trauma that accompanies mass incarceration. Yaakov, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation today and for walking, listening, and learning with us.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me here.
Take care. Thank you for joining us. That's it for this episode of Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Until next time, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Thank you for walking, listening, and learning with me. Let's stay on this path towards justice, equity, and opportunity for all.